Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here and Chad Marquitz both hosting this weekend show, and I want to refocus everybody on some of the daily editorials we recorded throughout this week, because as the week started off with some high volatility and a pretty sharp sell-off in a wide range of markets, the markets bounced back shortly after on Tuesday, to be exact, and then the tail end of the week, a little bit quieter, really just goes back to this whole summer doldrums trading. But back to the daily editorials that we were posting throughout the week, we were covering a lot of the short-term moves in the metals and U.S. markets, but also a lot of company updates. So please go back and check out those company updates, because right now, even as markets are slow and unfortunately precious metal stocks still under a bit of pressure, good time to get up to speed with a lot of companies and at least maybe trim your shopping list or isolate those companies a bit more. That being said, let's get into this weekend show, which we will focus a lot on active investing in mostly the resource space. Shad and I are starting off this show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, you just sent out your investor letter, which I will provide a link to for all of you listening to read over. His full investor letter takes you through the allocation of the MJG Capital holdings and broadly Matt's strategies. Let's start off with a strategy you've had really throughout this year, and that is increasing the portfolio or the fund's cash position. We've talked about this on prior calls this year, but so far, that's been a great strategy in the resource sector, unfortunately, because stocks have been drifting lower. Matt, take us through the reasoning behind this strategy and if you're continuing to build up cash currently.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me back on the program, gentlemen. Always good to be with you. You're right. I mean, that's been one of the very key focuses over the past 6 months here. The other is just sitting tight and being disciplined. So we've only initiated two new positions over the past 6 months as well. But the fund as of June 30th is at a 12% cash weighting. That's the highest that it's been in quite some time. Usually we're running pretty close to fully deployed at the end of 2020. So 6 months ago, we were at 5% for context. So we've more than doubled there. We're a long only fund. So this is really our way to hedge. It's to carry a healthier cash position. And you know, the reasoning is this: we're in a difficult spot here as natural resource focused investors. From my perspective, the general markets, asset classes broadly, are at a pretty serious risk of a sustained correction here at some point in the near future. Jeremy Grantham's on the record of saying that we're in the bubbles of all bubbles. And we know if there's a sustained risk off event, or when there's the next sustained risk off event, similar to what we saw in spring of last year, spurred on by coronavirus, we're going to get hit hard, very hard in the natural resource space, even if the cause of the sell-off's at no fault of our own. And so, when I look out there and I see the return of retail investors and mass to the market, I see the SPAC and cryptocurrency crazes that have been ongoing now for a good year plus. Just looking at the spread of growth to value names. Looking at the fact that valuations are in the top decile of what they've been historically over the past 100 years, like the anecdotal evidence is just, it's laid out clearly that we are in a euphoric stage of the market and the animal spirits are certainly out. And so, that said, from a natural resource perspective, looking back historically, we're still very, very well positioned here for the coming years. Even after the strong period of 15 odd months of performance since the coronavirus sell-off last spring, natural resource equities generally, commodity futures themselves, on a whole host of metrics, we're at historical lows, at or near historical lows, going back 100 years when comparing prices and equity mining equities to the broader stock market, to the S&P 500 in particular. And so that to me gives me gives me strong conviction here over the coming years, coming decade, per se, that we're in the right sandbox. But there's always the risk in the near term of sharp pullbacks, 30-40% pullbacks, as we saw last spring. This cash is kind of following the mindset of it's better to be approximately right than 100% wrong. we're at 12% now. We'll be building up towards 20% over the course of the next 6 months, assuming that the market remains strong or, largely flat. And, this will ensure that our downside is at least somewhat blunted when we do see that next major risk off episode. And just as importantly, it'll ensure that we have dry powder ready to go to deploy next time that there's blood in the street. So I imagine that will be in the 15 to 20% range here, for the foreseeable future. And when it's time to deploy, we'll know. It will be clear. It will be panic days. Portfolio will have probably experienced a healthy drawdown. Names that we're following and like can be down 30-40%. At that point, it's time to deploy some of this capital. And in the meantime, let's say things keep running here, and we have a second half of 2021 that rivals the second half of 2020, where the MJG fund was up over 100%. It is 102% over a 6 month period. Unprecedented performance, at least from our inception. And if that happens, then great. We're still heavily exposed here. So I think it's prudent to be increasing cash, and that's how we're going about it. That's how we're thinking about it.
Yeah, Matt, you've had a great performance in the fund, and it makes a lot of sense to have moved some of the chips off the table into a little bit more secure position with the cash to be able to pounce on those pullbacks when they do come. Maybe share with us some of your thoughts when you had that nice run up in the fund and there was different commodities and different sectors and different positions you had running. What ones did you lighten up on? What commodities or what areas or subsectors? And what ones did you put a little more focus on as you rebalanced the portfolio, keeping in mind some of that went to cash for a rainy day?
Well, I guess going back to summer and fall of last year, that was when precious metals were in the midst of that historic run where we saw an all-time gold price of just below $2,100 an ounce. And so, going back to last August, We got up to 75% precious metals waiting there for a matter of a few weeks, kind of right towards the peak in August. And so at that point, out of prudence, I mean, we're a natural resource focused fund. We're already focusing on a pretty narrow niche of the market. We're not going all in on precious metals at any point in the future, nor would we go all in on battery metals for that matter, or any specific slice of the resource industry. I made the decision at that point not to initiate any new gold or silver focused positions for the foreseeable future. And that actually remains the case today. We've added to names in recent months that are existing holdings within the portfolio, but we haven't initiated any new gold or silver focused names since that time period. So that's helped bring our precious metals exposure back down. I think we're sitting right around 35% at the moment between gold and silver focused names. And that's just due to the correction we've seen, as well as some profit taking and restraint from initiating new positions. Then, for the remainder of 2020 and into early 2021, it was the battery metals time to shine. You saw it across the board, whether it's copper, lithium, rare earths are getting attention again. Uranium seen a lot of speculative interest in recent months. And so, then at that point, by February, which was kind of the short-term peak that we saw in terms of this flurry of speculative interest, we were closer to 60% energy metal weighted at that point. There has been a pullback in recent months. It got too euphoric. Valuations got ahead of themselves. And we did take some profits in some names lightly. One of them I mentioned in the investor letter, Nova Royalty, which is our largest position within the portfolio, and a name that, assuming management stays disciplined and keeps things lean as they have been, I imagine it's going to be a position here for a number of years. I really like the strategy that they're executing here, and they have the platform to do it at their current market cap, the company's current positioning. But even then, we have a hard limit on position sizing within the portfolio at 20% for a given name. and Nova ran up so much that it was prudent to trim. So I think we're at 80% of our original position there. It was still a core holding. So again, now I feel as if we're pretty well balanced at the moment. We're somewhere between 35-40% energy metal focused at the moment, somewhere around 35% precious metal focused. We have some ag mineral exposure in there as well. And then our decent cash position. So I'm not feeling overexposed at the moment to any particular niche of the resource space.
So Matt, one aspect of the sector that we were chatting about even before recording here is the prospect generator model. So the companies that build up a lot of different properties, sometimes around the world, sometimes focused in certain jurisdictions, do surface work or some of the easier exploration work to generate targets, and then look for partners to spend their money on exploring these targets. This model kind of come out of favor recently. A lot of investors seem to be more focused on the companies that are drilling their own projects and those ones that are having success. But you think that this prospect generator model is going to return back into favor for investors. Why do you think that?
I do. And you're absolutely right. I would be a bit more aggressive there, actually, and say it's been out of favor for over a decade now. It's been a period of a lot of folks giving up on the business model in its entirety. There are various reasons for that. I would just say generally though, we're entering into what is going to be an exploration bull market here in the coming years. It's an exciting time. We've really seen the major producers out there for a couple decades now, really since the early 2000s. Focus on growing their reserves through decreasing their cutoff grades and advancing their later stage assets, and that's worked for a matter of years. But I think the major producers here pushed the limit, and there's limited additional ounces that can be gleaned from both of these. So discovery is going to be necessary here, really across the board, in order to replenish the pipelines of these major producers. And so I feel very strongly that majors that have slashed their exploration teams and slashed their budgets over the past couple decades, we're going to see the reverse of that in these coming few years. Them rebuilding their teams and doing exploration on their own, as well as partnering with geologically competent prospect generators. Whether that's through a strategic alliance, whether that's through joint ventures, whether that's through earning deals with these parties. There's going to be a steady stream of news coming forward. And a recent example would be Riverside with their announcement of BHP with the Copper Strategic Alliance in northern Mexico. And again, this is a niche of the market where you're not seeing a lot of speculative premium built into many of these share prices. A lot of these companies are trading with pretty healthy working cap to market cap ratios, which is a sign of potentially lower risk. A couple of the prospect generators that we've been buying in the portfolio in recent weeks and months, Golden Valley Mines and Lara Exploration, are trading right towards the lower end of their 52-week ranges. This is definitely kind of the value way to play this market and to play exploration in particular. In terms of metrics, I did want to mention for your listeners a couple things that I look at when evaluating these companies specifically. Beyond the rest of the good stuff that we've discussed on previous interviews, the people, are they properly incentivized? Do they have the right skill set? Are they focused on big opportunities, all of that. But three metrics in particular that I find useful for prospect generators. The first is, as I mentioned, looking at the company's working capital position, we can say cash plus marketable securities, relative to their market cap. And this is a good approximation for downside risk. This will give you a sense of, in a worst case scenario. And of course, companies can trade below their cash and marketable security position. That does happen on occasion, but this will give you a good sense of, if shit hits the fan, so to speak, in this industry, how bad it could get. And the aforementioned Golden Valley Mines, I mean, they have a cash and marketable security position well in excess of their current market cap, which is pretty shocking. So you're getting the rest of the company for free there. So that's one thing to look at in terms of downside risk. Second metric is the runway to their next financing. And so, you know, more specifically, that would be the company's total working capital position divided by their monthly all-in burn. And that will give you a sense of how long they can go without raising additional capital. And I should note, some of these prospect generators, either have a healthy enough working capital position, or maybe have inflows from advanced royalty payments, or one or two cash flowing royalties. Some of these companies aren't going to have to raise at all. So that's an important point to keep in mind as well. But when you're looking at this runway to the next financing, that's a good measure of the dilution risk. And as we know in this industry, dilution is perhaps the number one enemy of investors in this space. And that's one of the beauties of the prospect generator business model. It's built and designed to minimize dilution, at least with this expiration focus. And then the third metric to look at is what I'd call synthetic revenues versus the company's enterprise value. And so what synthetic revenues are basically the partner expenditures that are expected over the next 12 months. So they might have, multiple, majors earning in on a couple different assets. You take those projected expenditures and then compare it to the company's EV. And that gives you a sense of value. That gives you a sense of how much bang for your buck are you getting by buying the company at the current share price. And so I think these are interesting metrics to use to evaluate the prospect generator space in mass. There's 30 or 40 of these companies, and if you want to do a proper deep dive, line them up 1 through 40 and look at them on these three metrics, and you'll see a few of the names pop up at the top of each of these measures. That's the approach that we take when looking at this space.
Matt, I like that you have a systematic approach to it and that you're looking at these different metrics across the board. But just from a more high level point of view, when you're looking at positioning and prospect generators and how much of your fund you deploy to that business model, are you more interested in companies that are, and I know it's depending on these metrics, but are you also more interested in companies that have a model where they eventually turn their projects into royalties or into more of the JV side of thing where they have a strategic stake in a lot of different projects? Because the pro side of the prospect generator model is, hey, they're diversified across different projects, similar to a royalty company. But the hit that they take sometimes from people in the marketplace and why some investors avoid them is they're so diversified that if they hit on one of their projects, it doesn't move the needle as much as it was on an individual explorer. So I'm just curious as to what you look for most in the prospect generator. Is it something where they're accumulating royalties over time and building a model that way? Or are you looking for one where the JVs are important enough that it still could move the needle?
Good question. I think that's a fair point. I mean, that's the trade-off with prospect generators, right? If you're investing in this business model, you're conceding that if there is a discovery at any of these major projects that the company stake, you're only going to be getting 20% of the pie, and that's if you're looking at it on a project level stake. So you should also, to your point, pay particular attention to the terms of these actual agreements. Is it a free carry through production? Is it a free carry through feasibility? Is it a free carry through a spending milestone? And then the prospect generator themselves are going to have to stump up capital to advance the project, which is obviously less ideal. So those are all things to look at there. I do see a lot of these companies, due to the success of the royalty business model, which is still, within the mining space, a centuries old industry, royalty business model is still a very new innovation here. And it's certainly taken the precious metals industry by storm over the past couple decades. And I think that will continue, and we'll also see increasing prominence amongst the base metal space as well. So that's a way for some of these sleepy prospect generators that have maybe been neglected for a number of years here to revitalize their chances. From my perspective, in terms of new deal flow, tailor it so that the royalty is at the forefront of what you're looking for, and that's going to help you attract investors in this type of market environment. It also makes you a potential takeout target at some point for one of these many junior royalty companies, which are, you know, getting hungrier and hungrier for earlier stage assets. And you've seen examples, you know, of Transition Metals, for instance, doing a deal with Nova Royalty. Pacific Empire, another prospect generator, did as well. So there's already examples of royalty companies out there willing to come in and transact with these prospect generators and take some of the royalties off their hands in exchange for cash and shares. You know, obviously the pioneer of this type of royalty generation model is EMX, EMX Royalty. It's Dave Cole's company there. Paul Stevens out of San Francisco is the largest individual shareholder. Very, very high quality company. It is a fund or it is a holding within MJG. And, you know, they've made a practice of doing this for a couple decades now. I'd actually argue that the fact that they're out there staking new projects, working them, proving them up a little bit, and then bringing in partners, it's being held against them, you know, by the market currently. EMX, relative to some of the other, you know, royalty names, has a relatively high G&A. But I think a lot of folks are escaping that a lot of that money is going into the ground or, you know, to highly qualified geologists that are out there, you know, coming up with new exploration thesis, staking, you know, forgotten or new districts, and then working those projects to the point where they get them in the hands of bigger parties ready to spend significant sums on them. And so there's also the chance here of you know, further consolidation amongst these kind of hybrid project generation names, but that are, you know, amassing larger and larger royalty portfolios. So be interesting to see if EMX is one of those consolidators. You know, that company in particular is very, very specific in terms of price, very disciplined, you know, to their credit. So maybe they won't ultimately end up being the consolidator. But I think that somebody's going to step up here, and we'll start to see some of the higher quality project generators, if they're not getting traction on their own, start to get taken out.
All right, Matt, let's shift our focus a little bit now to the battery metals sector, because you did have a pretty comprehensive update on battery metals and also a company that you initiated an investment in, Strategic Resources. This ties in more to the vanadium sector. Why battery metals? What do you like about battery metals? What's your overall thesis for that sector?
Right. So, again, I want to emphasize, you know, my focus as an investor is on the, you know, company specific fundamentals. So it is on the people involved. It is, you know, generally on the quality of the asset. It's on the company's financial structure, upcoming catalysts, price to value, all of that good stuff. So I try to avoid getting swept into the, you know, to the latest theme of the month or latest trend. But I will say, I mean, it's pretty clear to anybody following this space that decarbonization and the trend towards decarbonization on a global basis is going to transform the mining industry over the coming decades here. And I think this is an excellent way to position yourself, you know, for that transformation, whether it's the nickel, you know, that's going into lithium ion batteries, or the copper, that's the lifeblood of an electrified economy, taking electricity from point A to point B, or, you know, the rare earths that are going into high strength magnets and our EV engines or wind turbines or what have you. You know, this is also a theme that has the ability to attract generalist capital back into our space. And also say, you know, this is more of a hunch at this point. And, you know, we'll, as the years go on, I think we'll get some more empirical evidence on this fact. But I have the sense that these battery metal focused projects, at least on the development side of things, are actually going to have easier permitting progression than some of the other, you know, especially relative to hydrocarbons, but even maybe relative to gold. I think it's easier to get social buy-in. You know, both on a federal and potentially on a local level, but certainly on a federal level for some of these projects, because they're feeding into this clean energy trend. And so, you know, for all these reasons, it's a healthy percentage of our portfolio. I mean, the bulk of the of our energy metal exposure comes from copper, which is, you know, the easiest way to play the space, you know, at large. Very, very limited substitution risk for copper, particularly at these prices. So as the world continues to electrify, copper is going to be a key beneficiary and an unquestionable piece of the picture going forward.
Well, Matt, there's no doubt that the energy metal space has a lot of different facets, but it's definitely been in vogue, whether it's copper, lithium, uranium, even some interest in the rare earths, as you mentioned. There has been a pretty good run that a lot of the companies went on. And some people are even now throwing platinum and palladium in there with some of the fuel cell technology. So there's a lot of different ways to play it. But as you mentioned, copper in particular was the one that you had weighted the heaviest. And you, I think it'd be nice to back up the clock and look at what you looked at in copper a year ago and how you see it today. And then maybe just a quick thought on what you think of the uranium market. So particularly copper and uranium, what are you looking at with those two sectors and the companies you're positioned in?
Well, in the July 2020 investor letter, backing up there, there was a piece called Copper, Gold, and a False Choice. And again, this the context then was that we were in the midst of the run up to all-time high gold prices, and precious metals were the rage. And copper and really the rest of the energy metal complex was being forgotten. And the point I made there was pretty simple. It wasn't a dramatic call on copper about to spike. It was though a statement looking back at the past 40 years that copper had never been cheaper relative to gold over that period, and that was the case in July and August of last year. And so it seemed clear to me that if you were bullish on gold, you should also be bullish on copper. I'm a big believer in reversion to the mean. That's generally what happens when you look at history. Of course, there are the occasional paradigm shift here or there, but it just didn't. The disparity in valuations between prices between the two metals just did not square with my understanding of copper's essential role in the continued decarbonization of the global economy. And so it was making the point that reversion to the mean is likely, and gold could stay flat and the copper price would have to go up 60-75% in order to hit the 40-year mean. And I did note in the article that this is going to be a long-term process and it'll take years of patience. I was very much wrong on that. In the past 10 months here, we have seen copper come all the way back. When I wrote that article, it was trading around $2.75 per pound. It hit an all-time high of roughly $4.80 per pound in early May here. And gold has stayed largely flat over this period. It's pulled back actually 10% from the all-time high that we saw last August. So now looking at this same metric, you can say that copper is trading fairly relative to gold, at least from a historical standard. And so I think it's hard to make a definitive call. And I try to stay out of the prediction business at all. It's just the disparities we saw last summer drew me to the point where I needed to comment on it and call it out. Just for some context for your listeners, and often you'll see in these mean reversion processes for the pendulum to overshoot. So there is a possibility that copper 6 months from now, 12 months from now, gets quite expensive relative to gold in a historical basis. And I was doing some rough numbers. If we saw the same copper to gold ratio that we saw in 2006, 2007, so kind of in the later stages of the 2002, 2007 China-driven commodity boom, you could in theory see copper at $10 a pound without gold moving an inch from this 1800 or 1900 per ounce range. That's not a prediction. I'm not expecting that to happen, but that is in theory within the realm of possibility. Should inflation remain strong and global growth remain strong as well. Which would probably continue the trends that we've seen over the past 9 months or so. And then you asked for a quick comment on uranium. We're down to about 6% uranium exposure within the portfolio. It actually got as high as close to 15% or so in the spring. But our core uranium position, we've taken some healthy profits there. It's still a decently sized holding. In hindsight, given the price action we've seen over the past 4 to 8 weeks, that was a good choice to take some profits. I love uranium as a metal here. It's another of these energy metals that's integral for the world's decarbonization plans going forward, even if a lot of folks don't realize that yet. But the reality is, especially some of the more speculative juniors just got far ahead of themselves. And, you know, uranium still continues to be priced in the low 30s, at least on a spot basis. And, you know, many of these companies were trading at, you know, 1x NPV multiples, you know, at $60 uranium, you know, and not factoring in permitting risk or, you know, long timelines to production. And so things just got ahead of itself. So, you know, we're starting to see a bit of a pullback here. I think if we go into a broader risk off, you know, period in the markets, uranium stocks are, you know, in particular risk of a very sharp pullback just because of the broad speculative interest we've seen. We've seen a ton of non-mining investors and traders and generalists and retail folks come into the space. And so, you know, again, this is a metal that I feel good about over a 3 to 5 year time horizon. But in the immediate term, if the market doesn't cooperate, there's certainly more potential pain ahead. And so, you know, my emphasis in terms of looking at new uranium focused names is to stay away really from the expiration names en masse. You know, from my perspective, there's enough pounds in the ground that have already been discovered, but are not currently under production, where the bar is just so high in terms of new discoveries in order to make a dent in a meaningful timeline on the industry. And, you know, so really focusing on the handful of later stage development assets that have true production potential, you know, this decade. And, you know, even taking a look at, you know, larger producers, Kazatomprom, which is not a fund holding, but, you know, it's a name that I'm keeping close tabs on. And I think there's also, you know, merit, you know, looking at the UPCs of the world or the yellow cakes as well is probably the easiest way to play the actual metals future prospects without taking on, you know, company specific risks. So I would urge caution for investors. I think it's going to be a great place to be over the coming 3, 4, 5 years, but that doesn't mean that a lot of these juniors couldn't be down 40%, you know, come December of this year. So it's a mixed picture for sure.
All right, Matt, we're going to wrap it up here. Sounds like still a little bit of patience is needed for a wide range of the resource sector. But hey, man, your comments always very insightful. I really appreciate you spending time with us on this weekend show and for this extended segment. I hope everybody got a lot out of that interview. And again, remember to click that link in that weekend show posting to read over Matt's investor letter out of MJG Capital. Matt, thanks again for your time, buddy. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You too, Corey. Thanks, Chad.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Matt Geiger. We are going to continue our focus on the precious metals segment here as we are chatting with Richard Postma, aka Doc. Now, Doc, I want to recap right now at least where we stand when it comes to the moves in precious metals and the underlying metal stocks. Now, I've talked a lot about this in the last week or two where the stocks have been greatly underperforming and the metal is still maybe trending lower but not getting hit nearly as hard as the underlying stocks. Quick little recap here. We are recording this later in the day on Thursday, but if we recap what's happened in July here, I found it very interesting in terms of it feels like July has been a very bad month for the metals and metals stocks, but compare that to June was way worse. And now comparing what's happened to gold, as we're recording this, just this month is actually up a little over 1.75%. So it's actually up for the month, but you look at something like GDX, GDX is down about 1.5%, and GDXJ is down about 5.5%. So again, the stock's greatly underperforming the metal, but it sure doesn't feel like this month that gold is actually up. I know it's marginal, but that actually surprised me when I started recapping just what's happened in the last couple months. What's your takeaway from this environment, Doc?
Yeah, I think you hit it perfectly, Corey. And you know, these poor stocks, some of them in the precious metal wants to stay fairly up there, you might say. But the stocks are just, you know, getting hammered. And that tells me that we probably are going to look at a little bit more movement down in the precious metals themselves in the next couple, 3-4 months. And because we're actually moving into a trading range when you look at the monthly Bollinger Bands, and they're starting to even out a little bit. And that's starting to tell you that we are now settling into an area that we're probably going to be in for some period of time. And it's a shame that the stocks comparatively have gotten hurt a lot worse, especially GDXJ. Than the metals themselves. But I think it just speaks to the fact that the metals are going to come down. Now, when they do, sure, the stocks might suffer a little bit more, but I think then you're going to see a reverse where the metals on a comparative basis get hurt more than the stocks.
Well, Doc, I'm sure that's not going to be music to anybody's ears that's investing in the precious metal space, but it's always nice to look at the charts. And as we were discussing off mic, sometimes it's best to take the emotions and the fundamentals out of it temporarily and just look at the price action and see what it's telling you. So what is the price action telling you when you look at the monthly charts for gold and silver? What are you seeing, and where would a good support level be that you would think, hey, this may be an area, or what would you be looking for technically for a support level to come in?
Well, everybody wants to talk about that double bottom, but the problem with that double bottom they were talking about in gold is that it was put together very quickly. And generally, when you see double bottoms like that, it's not necessarily a great sign. It's a great sign when you have another move down and then you really get a double bottom. And I think we're going to see that. I think we're going to move back down towards 1700, probably the upper 1600s. And we're going to really challenge that intraday or intra-month, the double bottom at 1673. I think that'll probably happen. Now, the discouraging thing is that you're having these stocks get hit so hard. Then you go back to March of 2020, and we got way back. The gold price got way down into the 1400s. Well, we're not going to see that. But unfortunately, the stocks, a lot of them are going to double bottom as far as their months, their March 2020 lows. Some won't, but a lot of these stocks will. And I think you can expect it, especially in the JDXJ patterns and in those stocks. Not so much in the other bigger category of stocks. They'll move down toward a double bottom, but they might not reach that double bottom of theirs. But some of these smaller companies will.
Well, Doc, you bring up an interesting point when you bring up the March 2020 low, because that was a little bit unique in that it was a pandemic crash. And like you mentioned, gold got down to $14.50. Silver was down around $13. I mean, as of the day of this recording, we're at $1,800 gold and $25 silver. But the miners, and in particular the ones that are not in the GDX or not in the GDXJ, some of the junior miners that a lot of the folks probably listening to this hold have been smashed down 30% lately, 40%, some even 50% off their highs. And that's not even counting the fact that we were already correcting from August of last year before we had that March double bottom and had the little lift in April and May. So the action in the junior miners, it may be indicating lower prices in the metal, but these miners are trading like we're back at $14.50 or $13 silver. So why do you think there's such a huge disconnect in the juniors compared to what we're seeing in the mid-tiers and the seniors that are held in those indexes? Where could this disconnect be coming from?
Well, some of them are actually paying dividends, which I guess is a positive. And people realize that when we get the next big move up, as they're going to see it in the big and mid-tier producers, actually, and that these smaller companies will once again will lag. And so I think a lot of people are still holding some of their positions because of that. And so they're shedding themselves of the explorers and the, and even if they come in with good news right now, it's not impacting them hardly at all. But I do feel that the next time we move up, I think that's finally going to be the time that we really see some good moves in these stocks, whereas it's been very discouraging over the last few years where you're seeing higher gold prices and even silver prices, but yet these stocks don't respond. But a lot of these companies are being run more responsibly now. And if they continue this, the next big move, I think we're going to see some really great moves in some of these companies.
So the question being, Doc, when are we going to see that next big move? Because it seems like every bounce we've had over that last 11 months has been sold into, unfortunately.
Well, you're farming, as I mentioned before, you're starting to farm with the Bollinger Bands on the monthly chart. You're starting to farm a trading range. And way back in when we had that move down in 2011 and 12, gold lost almost 50% of its value. Well, this time, we're not going to see that. We're going to see probably it move down and lose maybe 30 to 35% at most, I feel. And so it's going to be held up pretty well. And I think we're going to enter a trading pattern here. You might as well write off the end of the year, I believe. And I think 2022 is going to be a stabilization year. And I think the earliest we can hope for where we get the really start of a big move is going to be 2023.
Doc, what's going to predicate that big move? Because we've been hearing a lot that the metals, to get going again, especially precious metals, need a market correction. And I even heard you in the last couple of weeks saying that maybe the market is setting up for a correction. We saw a bit of a correction, but that was on Monday, and then the markets were bought back immediately. Again, just more or less confirming that whole buy the dip mentality for these markets. Is that still what precious metals bugs need to be holding on hope for? Is that market correction coming that will drive the investors back into gold?
I wouldn't count on that, Corey, because if we get an initial sell-off, if we get a good sell-off in the conventional markets, I don't think it's going to help us for a while because there's going to be real fear that starts if we get a significant sell-off, because I think we get a significant sell-off in housing as well. And I think, in fact, that's peaking already. The home builder sentiment is horrible right now. And also the home buying sentiment is not good. And I think we are peaking. I think that almost $1,000 drop that one day is sending a message right now. And as I've said before, in the last couple of months, that MACD on the monthly charts for the conventional markets is at areas I haven't seen in multi-years. And that's telling you something. It can't go much higher here. And I think it's starting to signal a topping pattern here in the conventional market. And when we get a sell-off, at first, I don't think it's going to help the gold market. I think if we get a sell-off, it's going to be well into 2022. So that could be a little depressive effect on gold and silver. But also, they won't get hurt that bad because I think they've already had a good part of their sell-off, and we're going to get a little bit more. But I think it stabilizes then.
Well, Doc, one question that I just need to ask you, because I'm sure other people are wondering the same thing, is at what point will you feel comfortable scaling into some of the mining stocks with a little bit more, you know, of an aggressive position? I know that occasionally you nibble at a couple, and I know your philosophy is to buy on weakness, which is smart, you know, to accumulate the dips. But at what point, if you think that the metals price may take until next year or even 2023 before it really gets going, when will you start really, or what will you be looking for when you start adding a little bit more aggressively to mining stocks?
I will wait for the monthly on gold to move on the MACD toward a neutral position or a zero position on the MACD. We're a ways away from that. And the strength indicators are still decent, which is really encouraging because that tells me there's underlying strength for this market. It's signaling that don't be too concerned about this. But I will watch watch how the 12 and 26 month moving averages are performing. And as they move down, and I've said it before, I think we're going to be I think it's going to be the first quarter of next year where we might finally get some stabilization. And there will come a point in time where I'll say personally that I'm getting really bullish for the first time. I did that back in 2019. I believe it was on June 12 point in time where Corey and I were having a discussion where I said finally after years that I was getting bullish for the first time. Well, a week later, gold market started to take off. And I'm going to, at some point in time when the technicals look pretty good to me, I'll be saying, hey, I'm starting to feel really bullish here.
Okay. Well, Doc, we'll follow up with you. Hopefully we get that comment sooner rather than later, but it sounds like we might need to wait until next year for that more bullish outlook and that all clear to buy. But hey, I know there's a number of people still trying to scale into some of these stocks as they are correcting. And I think these stocks are due for a bit of a bounce. Let's just see how sustainable that bounce can be. Doc, great chatting with you. Thanks for taking time on this weekend show. I'm sure we'll chat again in another couple weeks. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this final segment, I am replaying really the first half of an interview that we had earlier on this week. It was posted on Thursday out of Skeena Resources. I'm replaying this interview because this was some pretty important fundamental news out of the company releasing their pre-feasibility study that was very good in a lot of different respects. Chad and I were joined by Walter Coles, and we discussed really the ins and outs of this PFS and then the additional growth opportunities of the company. I hope you all enjoy this final segment, and to hear the full interview, be sure to visit our website, kereport.com. Click on that Thursday posting. Hey everyone, welcome in to a daily editorial here on the KE Report. I'm kicking off today's daily editorials with an update from Skeena Resources, traded on the TSX under the symbol SKE and on the OTCQX under the symbol SKREF. Chad and I are chatting with the president and CEO, Walter Coles. Now, Walter, I wanted to get this interview out early today because the company just released some key news on the PFS, pre-feasibility study, at the Eskay Creek property. Now, you have provided us a couple slides, actually a slide presentation outlining this PFS and also some of the work that's going to be done to continue to expand and grow this asset. I will post a link to that full slide deck. And I will also pull out a couple slides that we focus on here throughout this interview for easy reference. Now, the first couple slides in this slide deck really talk about the location of the Eskay Creek project, also the SNIP project that is held by Skeena Resources, both in really the heart of the Golden Triangle. And one of the slides also outlines the infrastructure that is around these assets. A lot of that is because of the historical production on these assets and really its location in the Golden Triangle around some other well-known mines. Let's start on slide 6 here. Now, we have the 2021 resource estimate. We already had those numbers of over 5 million ounces in measured and indicated, but now we're seeing the reserve statement, the conversion to reserves here, 3.88 million ounces gold equivalent at just short of 4.6 grams per ton. Let's start here, Walter. Take us through the conversion here into reserves to support this PFS, please.
Yeah, thanks, Corey. We're really excited to achieve this milestone, getting this PFS out, really an important step in this project evolution. I'd say, you know, as a note to all of your audience, this is a snapshot in time. We're going to continue to grow this project, but this is where we are today. You know, what's so important that's come out of this PFS, the first is the conversion from resource to reserves. We had a conversion rate of about 76%. So when you move from resource to reserves, now we have a much higher confidence level in what's here and economics around it. So the reserves that are presented in the PFS, it's 3.88 million ounces of gold equivalent. The grades actually improved a little bit from the PEA. In the PEA, we're around 4.3 grams. Now we're up to 4.6 grams. So, you know, always happy to see any kind of improvement in grade. I'd highlight that we, with that resource estimate that we published a couple months ago, we converted most of the inferred over to measured and indicated, but there still is a little bit of inferred, and we're drilling that out right now. So we'll, you know, hopefully as we move from the PFS to the pre-feasibility, we'll add another, you know, say 175, 200,000 ounces, and the reserves will go over 4 million ounces. So great work by Paul and his team on the resource delineation and now the reserves.
All right, let's get into slide 7, because this really summarizes the numbers here of this PFS. And using the base case, U.S. gold price $1,550, silver price of $20 U.S., we're seeing an after-tax NPV of $1.4 billion Canadian, an after-tax IRR of 56%, and CapEx here looks to be U.S. dollar-wise $381 million. This looks like a cash flow generating asset right here, Walter. Take us through the PFS, the summary here on this slide, and also some of the sensitivities to the underlying gold and silver prices.
Yeah, so you know, I'd add to your description and just point out the lowercase. At $1,400 gold, this project still has a 49% after-tax IRR. So there's margin of safety with this asset, and that's because of the grade, again, that 4.6 grams per ton. Of course, if you go the other direction, if you look at it at say, you know, $1,700 gold, the IRR jumps to 62%. The annual after-tax cash flow is $300 million a year over a 10-year mine life. So, you know, the financial metrics for this project are nothing short of awesome. In terms of differences from the PEA to the PFS, we've grown the production profile. In the PEA, it was 306,000 ounces a year. Now we're up to 350,000 ounces a year. In the PEA, the mine life was 8.7 years. Now we're up to 10-year mine life. The all-in sustainable cost came down. It was around $600 U.S. per ounce. Now the life of mine all-in sustainable cost is down to $548 per ounce. And that's a consequence of both the improvement in grade and that we were able to achieve a higher grade concentrate. So that cut our shipping costs down and it gave us slightly higher payable terms from the smelters. In terms of CapEx, CapEx has gone up. In the PEA, the CapEx was $230 million U.S. Now we're $381 million. So a meaningful jump in the CapEx. And that is the, you know, the biggest driver of the increase in CapEx was additions to the mill circuits to enable us to target a higher grade concentrate. And also the improvements in the mill flow sheet have enabled us to remove more of the deleterious elements, which has significantly reduced the amount of penalties we pay to the smelters. So great work by everyone on our engineering team led by Shane Williams on this PFS. It's just it's a great result, but I would add, you know, we're pleased with it, but not satisfied, because we think there's going to be further improvement between the PFS and the feasibility study, which we're targeting to have out in about 6 months. You'll see another jump in the production profile with the feasibility study.
Well, Walt, just as it is, it's already quite impressive. And when I look at the production profile, what you expect, just 450,000 in the first 5 years and a life of mine of about 352, even if that continues to ramp up, it's already a fairly world-class project at this point. And I may actually just jump ahead to one slide, which is slide 12 on there, and that's how this production profile would stack up to other similar mines in the area. Could you review just where it is now and how it would stack up to other mines in the area?
On this slide, we took other open pit. We ranked other open pit mines in Canada. The number one largest project open pit gold mine in Canada is Canadian Malartic, which is half owned by Agnico and Yamana. Last year, In 2020, it produced 578,000 ounces of gold. Detour Lake, number two, which is owned by Kirkland, that produced 517,000 ounces. And here we are. Eskay, if it were in production today, as defined by the PFS, it would be producing 350,000 ounces. So that would make Eskay Creek the third largest gold mine in Canada. But as I mentioned, we're not going to rest on our laurels. You know, the whole team is pushing hard to keep growing this project while at the same time get it into production as quickly as we can. So, you know, everyone's excited. I mean, we all think that, you know, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to work on a project that's as stupendous, you know, incredible as Eskay. So we're not going to rest. I tell everybody it's this is not a marathon. It's a full-on sprint. So, you know, we're focused in trying to keep growing Eskay and make it bigger.
Well, that wraps up this weekend edition of the KE Report. I do want to remind everybody, please go back throughout the week, listen to our daily editorials and a lot of those company updates that we recorded. We're focusing a lot on companies right now because, quite frankly, the markets are slow. It's summer trading. And even though a lot of the stocks are still struggling, it's a great time to really dive into these companies and see what work they're doing and make sure their plans and their goals and their strategy really fit what you're looking for in some of your investments. As always, please keep in touch with Shad and I. Our email addresses are fleck@kereport.com and shad@kereport.com. We appreciate all the emails we get on companies that we have featured on the show or companies that you haven't seen on the show recently. We do our best to reach out to all of those companies and bring them on the show. I want to thank all of you for tuning in on this weekend show. I hope you all have a great weekend. Next week, a little bit less content as I will be on the road getting a little trip in, but we'll still be with you day after day covering these markets and what companies are up to. Everyone, have a great rest of your weekend.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.